Welcome to The Roundup, where we tackle big health topics from the outback to the tropics. I'm your host, Alyssa Hatherley, a local GP and head of James Cook University's Clinical School in Mackay. In each episode, you'll hear from experienced clinicians sharing expert insights on key regional health issues, best practice approaches, and practical strategies to improve patient care in regional and rural settings. Before we begin, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their contributions to healthcare, and the traditional owners of the lands in which we practice and provide education. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Tim Squires, a radiation oncologist from Townsville. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me on.
It's so important to have you here to talk about radiation oncology. What is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and a lot of people kind of wonder and ask me that. So I have a very privileged position of treating patients with cancer, first and foremost, and we do that with radiation therapy, where we use radiation to either try and cure the particular cancer that the patient has, or in some instances we use the radiation treatment to palliate difficult symptoms to manage, particularly pain and that sort of thing, which is a very rewarding component of my job. Another part of my job is to supervise registrars as well as junior medical doctors and medical students and elective students, particularly from JCU, which I really enjoy. And then I also do a bit of research on the side as well.
That's a really interesting and varied portfolio of work you've developed, Tim. Why have you ended up in North Queensland doing this work?
Very good question. So my background prior to medical school was in imaging. I did radiography and ultrasound and then eventually became a doctor. So I was always interested in imaging, whether it be I was going to do radiology or radiation oncology. And I did a radiology rotation in Wagga and got to do cool interventional stuff, but couldn't bring myself to sitting down and spending my life looking at imaging. I like imaging, but I also like chatting with patients and also using a lot of cool technology, which is what we do in radiation oncology. It's a rapidly innovative, evolving field. And so I got on the training program in Canberra, and I was in Sydney with young children and didn't really want to move, but the reality is that I wanted to go anywhere where I could get on the training program and get a job. So really enjoyed working in Canberra, where I did my registrar's years and locumed, and also worked in some Sydney hospitals as well. And then permanent job position came up in sunny Townsville, which I hadn't really heard of apart from the North Queensland Cowboys. So came here and had a look around, and it's a great department here. And I was particularly drawn to work in a regional centre, which has progressively through my career, I've been working in smaller and smaller centres and dragging my family around. So came here and have really enjoyed it since 2021, particularly being director of training and supervising junior doctors and telling them about how great radiation oncology is as a career choice.
Oh, good on you for switching allegiance to the Cowboys. I am still firmly wedded to Manly Sea Eagles, unfortunately.
I know about them, but I don't necessarily support them. I'm not a big rugby league, much to the chagrin of, most people up here. But anyway, certainly a lot of the active lifestyle and sport I have embraced up here, particularly with my kids as well, though.
That's fantastic, Tim. Now, there's a real increase in application for use of radiation oncology tools, isn't there, that probably the broader public has no idea about, but certainly for GPs and junior doctors, they may not understand all of the new opportunities that arise for treating our patients.
Yeah, it is tricky. It's a very rapidly evolving field. Radiation therapy has been around for over 100 years. I like to kind of spruik it as one of the earliest sort of cancer treatments. We're only trumped by kind of the surgeons who, in Egyptian times or even earlier were chopping things off. So then it came radiation oncology, and then only until recently systemic therapy in the form of chemotherapy came about, sort of 70s and 80s, which is a relatively new field. So radiation has been around for a long time and has been here to stay. nonetheless. And look, our treatment modality and technique has also improved. So back in the 80s, radiation used to be sort of planned with a plain RX ray, AP and lateral, and prescribed to a midpoint dose. So there would really be there'd be no understanding of where the actual soft tissue structures were in the body. So it's based on bony landmarks. And I think back from those days, that's where radiotherapy copped a bit of a bad rap with quite significant toxicities, which some patients or at least family members still recall. So sometimes they need some talking around to let them know that that has progressed to 3D data sets. So obviously using a CT scan, you can see where the soft tissue is, and then that was delivered with kind of blocks of radiotherapy. And then moving from that was IMRT, which was using kind of little beamlets of radiotherapy to shape the beam. And then more recently, VMAT, which is an even more conformal approach where the radiation beam rotates around the patient with these little beamlets. And there are also interest in other techniques not available in Australia at the moment, but including proton therapy and that sort of thing. So we're constantly evolving in terms of our technology, which only benefits cancer patients in terms of delivering a higher dose to the tumour and avoiding the nearby structures and delivering a much lower dose to those structures. So whenever I see patients, I say, look, you'll have your treatment. Generally speaking, you know, that one of the biggest inconveniences is actually coming to the hospital and finding a car park. You're not admitted to hospital. So when you can contrast that to potentially significant side effects with treatments that go through the whole body, like systemic therapy, or even compare it with surgery involving long hospital stays and general anesthetics. Instead, for us, you just come in and lie flat and keep still, and you know, you can even play your favourite music while you're getting treated as well. So it's a very well-tolerated treatment and an underutilised treatment, to put it that way.
Sure. So things like the lung fibrosis and pericarditis are hopefully more often than not side effects of the past, Tim?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends on our treatment site. But I recently actually just presented a paper in Journal Club today about sort of differential doses or much lower doses that are received now from patients that have had radiotherapy for Hodgkin lymphoma being treated to the mediastinum. So we looked at how much lower breast doses were with modern techniques, which obviously decreases the risk of secondary malignancy following radiation treatment. And similarly with lung doses and heart doses in terms of cardiovascular disease, because we know, particularly with Hodgkin lymphoma patients that have a high cure rate, there's very little point curing patients and causing their potential harm with cardiovascular disease or a lung or a breast cancer. So really, though, that improvement in technology that we have translates to better patient outcomes.
And is the schedule for dosing improving too, Tim? You mentioned patients just coming in as day patients for their treatment, but sometimes that will be 5 days a week for weeks on end, won't it?
Yep, absolutely. So there's a significant move within our field to what's called hypofractionation, which basically means a smaller number of fractions. Fractures are the amounts of radiation that we deliver each day. So we know from landmark trials, even in the Australian setting of lung cancer, where that used to be treated over 30 fractions or 30 treatments, that can be delivered over a few treatments now, 3, 4, or 5 treatments, and have actually the same, if not improved, outcomes. Similarly, with breast treatments that used to be over 25 treatments and moving to 15 treatments and even 5 treatments for early breast cancer. Similarly, with prostate cancer, which used to be treated over 39 treatments, went to 20 treatments, and we're now treating patients over 5 treatments as well with similar sort of outcomes. So that time burden for patients is certainly improving in terms of radiotherapy scheduling for them as well.
That's an incredible improvement, isn't it, Tim, and really opens access to more patients, which is always a big difficulty in the North Queensland setting, isn't it?
Absolutely. And particularly with regional and rural patients that you've mentioned, time away from home, time away from their farms and that sort of thing, or their jobs having an economical impact for them. And it's a more attractive option, particularly if you're comparing surgery, a radical prostatectomy, which may be sort of attractive in terms of a short hospital stay If you compared that with a 7 or 8 week course of radiotherapy, it can be a bit of a daunting thing for patients. But if you can drop that down to 20 treatments or even 5 treatments where appropriate, it's far more palatable for them.
Most definitely. Now, Tim, you did mention possibly the worst part of having radiation oncology treatments is finding a car park in our large hospitals and health services. What are some of the other side effects that patients might experience?
Yep. So interestingly, the radiation oncology training program, as a radiation oncologist, we don't have the same training program as medical oncologists, which medical oncologists will do physician training for a number of years and then eventually choose a specialty. Radiation oncology is different. We're under the College of Radiologists. And we do a totally dedicated radiation oncology training program, which is 5 years of just radiation oncology, no other specialties or anything like that. And the reason why I mention this is because in management of side effects of radiation treatment, inherently are fairly straightforward if we understand the radiation biology behind acute side effects. So they're the ones that patients can develop on treatment and peak a couple of weeks after treatment, because those cells are the rapidly dividing cells, and I describe it as a deck of cards. The ones that are dividing are at the bottom of the deck of the cards, but they take 2 weeks to get to the surface. So a lot of patients will say, oh, look, yeah, are you sure you got the machine turned on for the first couple of weeks? Because they don't notice anything. But towards the end of the treatment, they can have 2 weeks delay of potential side effects, which are fairly logical in management, which is what I was trying to get at in terms of our we don't have extensive physician training to manage these side effects. So it depends which site you're treating. I think of it like a torch beam. If you're treating a head and neck patient and treating the base of tongue, then that's where the side effects are going to be. This differs from systemic therapy such as immunotherapy, where you might have thyroiditis or red palms or ringing ears or all sorts of strange complications that you may or may not be able to link to your therapy. Radiotherapy is intuitive. So if I'm treating the base of tongue, that's where you'll get your side effects. And they can be manifested as mucositis because those cells are turning over quickly and pain associated with that. You can get some skin erythema related to that because those cells are turning over quickly. So the management of those sorts of side effects, which can occur really at any site where you're treating, so for me, prostate cancer, similarly, the rectum can be irritated from the radiation, or the bladder can be irritated from the radiation. The management of any of those acutely responding tissues can be conservative. So oral analgesia, xylocaine viscous, creams, basic sort of management like that. So our sort of management of these side effects is really, I suggest that the management for me is kind of my RMO level training before I got onto radiation oncology and did the specific training for radiation oncology. So the management of side effects is intuitive and generally just supportive. So we are predominantly an outpatient based field. It would be rare for us having to admit a patient to hospital. Some examples might be a head and neck cancer patient or a base of tongue cancer patient that I mentioned before that may need some help with nutrition in terms of an NG tube due to swallowing or something like that. But fortunately, we don't deal with complicated sort of side effects that our physician colleagues do with their systemic therapies.
That's really reassuring, isn't it? And something to highlight with our patients when we raise radiation oncology as an option in their treatment plan. Now, for those patients who have a really big cancer burden, though, with a lot of those cells dying off, do we get some potential problems with kidney injury or with fatigue?
Good question. So I'll just take up that fatigue question. So probably the only generalized side effect, so that's really the caveat to my torch-based analogy, is you can get radiation-related fatigue, the mechanism of which is largely unknown. And I say to patients that it's very patient-to-patient dependent. Mm-hmm. Some patients mentioned being very fatigued from, having a head and neck cancer treated versus a prostate cancer or a skin cancer. It's very difficult to estimate. I wouldn't say it would be based on the volume that we irradiated. But in terms of systemic side effects from radiation treatment, we also don't see too many of them in terms of blood work or that sort of thing. Tumor lysis syndrome, which you may expect from treating a high-grade lymphoma, that sort of thing with chemotherapy, would be very rare from treating a large irradiated volume, although that is something that we learn how to manage. So usually the larger burden of disease and in terms of systemic side effects is really the management of the medical oncologist or the hematologist that would be looking at their hydration status and that sort of thing.
So with so few potential side effects, are there in fact any contraindications to radiation therapy?
Yep. So we would generally divide these into sort of patient and tumour and treatment factors. So some of the big ones that we think about with patients, you know, age of patients. If you have a very elderly patient that may struggle with treatment, then we wouldn't necessarily treat them. If they're very comorbid and the benefit of radiation treatment is outweighed by their comorbidities, they'll have issues with something else. Patient preference and patient compliance are big ones to consider. So some patients need a lot of talking around to get them out of the sort of the 1980s sort of horror stories of radiation treatment and say, look, it's not that bad. We've come a long way since those days. Patient compliance is important as well. So with a lot of our advanced techniques, I mentioned sort of the 3 or 5 radiation treatment schedules. We would call that SABR, which is stereotactic ablative radiotherapy. Those can involve some logistics in terms of short turnaround times and having immobilization masks and being able to keep still for a period of time. So if a patient is unable to keep still or comply with our treatment, then sometimes we can't use those particular modalities.
Mm.
And then if we look at tumour sort of factors, we know that some certain tumours respond really well to radiation treatment in terms of hematological malignancies, where you can actually see shrinkages that day once you've treated patients, versus some other malignancies that can inherently be radio resistant. So traditionally, they're thought of as melanoma, although that can be a wide range, but particularly sarcomas as well. So if there was a surgical option that could provide equal outcomes versus radiation, then we may consider that. And then in terms of treatment factors, or staging of the cancer, I should say, actually, we would need to think about the indication of radiation treatment itself. What are we trying to achieve? Is it a curative option or a palliative option? That needs to be very clear and discussed with the patient of what we're trying to achieve. Very rarely with patients, they may have an acute radiation syndrome, which may increase their likelihood of radiation side effects. But of particular note, we need to be aware of concurrent treatments that a patient may be on. So a big one that is always a red flag for us is methotrexate, because we know that the job of that drug is to induce DNA damage. And if we're trying to induce DNA damage with the radiation and that's on board as well, there can be significant toxicities related to that. So in summary, I wouldn't say that there would be a total contraindication to radiation treatment. However, there can be very specific circumstances, like a pregnant patient is obviously, you would avoid radiation at all costs with a developing fetus in that regard.
Now, interesting. So, Tim, we've talked about the fact that radiation oncology is rapidly developing with new technologies and new modalities coming online all the time. We've talked about being able to reduce the dose, reduce the frequency, and be more localized when you're delivering the radiation to the tumor bed. We've talked about how much this has improved tolerability amongst our patients, with fewer side effects, fewer post-radiation complications, and the improvement in access and palatability for our patients. This is such an exciting, expanding, evolving opportunity for our patients to improve their health. What are the next steps with radiation oncology? Can you see any new treatments coming online on the horizon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a paradigm shift that we're facing in oncology is where we draw the line in terms of cure and palliation. So traditionally speaking, you know, once a cancer is spread, or what we call metastatic, then you would say that the patient is incurable, and therefore treatment intent of further treatment is going to be systemic therapy or something along those lines. So more recently, there's been trials that have been coming through in states of oligometastatic disease, which is kind of this grey area between having localised disease and grossly overt metastatic disease. And what these trials looked at is whether SABR, so that stereotactic radiation treatment that I've mentioned, if delivered to a small number of metastatic sites, could change the outcome or change the trajectory of the patient. And a lot of these have sort of different goals. It may be time off ADT or androgen deprivation therapy for prostate cancer, or time to delaying a change in systemic therapy. And what these trials have shown is that there's probably a progression-free survival benefit if you look at a big basket number of different tumour types, and which may translate into an overall survival benefit in the future with longer follow-up and more trials. So what we see nowadays is we have better imaging, and I'll use prostate cancer for an example, in terms of PSMA PET scans, which allow us to see these smaller deposits of cancer that we could treat as oligometastatic disease. So a patient might have a PSA rise after their prostatectomy or radiation treatment, and they might have a CT and a bone scan, which are negative. And then we might refer them for a PSMA PET scan, and this shows a couple of spots of cancer, maybe one in a bone and one in a lymph node. And I'll have a discussion with them and say, look, you might be able to avoid hormone injections for a period of time if we treat these two spots of metastatic disease. You know, this is an option for you. If we can do it with very little toxicity or any toxicity at all, then it can be a worthwhile endeavor to try and drop your PSA for a longer period of time. So I think there's probably a paradigm shift in terms of what we consider curable and what we consider incurable, and delaying potentially toxic systemic therapies, whether it be actual toxicity and also financial toxicity as well for patients. So that's an evolving sort of area of research.
Oligometastatic disease, that's a whole new term for me. Thanks, Tim. Now, in terms of the cost to patients, these treatments are getting fancier and fancier and more costly to our health system. But it sounds like in terms of cost saved to the community, it's a no-brainer in terms of investment, right?
Yep, I would think so. And in particular, if you need to, if there's less time on machines, you can also treat more patients as well. So if you're delivering less fractions, then you can use your time on your machines more effectively. The benefit of working in a public hospital is I also say to patients, look, you've paid your taxes your whole life. We can do this cancer treatment for free, which is very kind of rewarding, because patients will often ask if there's an out-of-pocket expense for their treatment. But in terms of the benefit of radiation treatment, which with external beam radiotherapy, which is what I've been discussing, all we need to use is electricity to make that radiation treatment. So that is the very basic principle of it, which differs very much to fancier agents that may be used by patients in particular, such as immunotherapy or even radionuclide therapy, such as lutetium, which can have very high costs to the patient and society per cycle of treatment as well. So there's a substantial difference in terms of cost benefit, I feel, for radiotherapy versus other treatment modalities as well.
Is there any chance, Tim, you can chuck your machines on the back of a truck and take them west, much like we do with breast screening or lung cancer screening operations?
Good question. I have sort of fantasized about this and having one near the beach, but I just live near the beach now anyway. So, but look, theoretically, you could have a machine that would be very low energy and maybe treat some skin cancers. But the reality is that in order for us to generate x-rays that are deep enough to penetrate in the patient, we need fairly large machines, but we equally need a significant amount of shielding around the machine. So it would have to be a very heavy truck, and that it would be a tricky endeavor to do that.
Oh, technology developing as rapidly as it is, Dr. Tim Squires in the Townsville region. I have no doubt you will have your cancer therapy available by the beach sometime very soon so that we can all enjoy cancer treatment where we live rather than having to travel away from home. Dr. Tim Squires from Townsville, radiation oncologist, senior lecturer with JCU, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks very much for your time, Alyssa. Greatly appreciated.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.